Hey, Brian, can you hear me?
Hey, Kelsey, I got you loud and clear.
All right, this is Mike 13.
Mike 13.
Mike number 12.
Mike 12.
Mike 11.
Mike 11.
Mike 10.
Mike 10.
Mike 9.
Mike 9.
Mike 8.
Mike 8.
Mike 7.
Mike 7.
Mike 6.
Mike 6.
Mike 5.
Mike 5.
Mike 4.
Mike 4.
Mike number 3.
3 sounds good.
You have testifier number 3.
Test 3.
Testifier number 2.
Test 2.
And testifier number 1.
Test 1. They all sound great.
Thanks,
Kelsey.
Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect it is 2:50 p.m. on Wednesday, May 12, 2021. Present in the room today are Representative Thompson, Representative LaVon, Vice Chair Ortiz, Co-Chair Foster, Representative Josephson, Representative Wool, Representative Johnson, and myself, Co-Chair Merrick. This afternoon, we will continue our discussion about the capital budget with two presentations. First, we'll hear about the Village Safe Water Program, then we'll hear from the Department of Law about one of their capital requests for prosecutor housing. Ruth Kostick and Carrie Bohan are both from the Department of Environmental Conservation. They're with us on Teams. Welcome to House Finance. If you could place your name and affiliation on the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. For the record, Ruth Kostick, Admin Services Director for the Department of Environmental Conservation, and I have with me today Carrie Bohan, who's the Facility Services Program Manager in the Division of Water. So we're going to be going through our slide presentation. Carrie is going to start off with talking about the program, and then I'll talk a bit about the funding for the program. So I'm going to hand it over to Carrie.
Good afternoon. Again, for the record, I'm Carrie Bohan, the Facilities Programs Manager with the Division of Water at the Department of Environmental Conservation. And I appreciate the opportunity to be here this afternoon to share with you a little bit of information about the Village Safe Water Program and the work that we do. So our mission at Village Safe Water is to support rural communities in their efforts to develop sustainable sanitation facilities. Our statute defines communities that are eligible for Village Safe Water funding and support. Typically, we consider that to be a population of 1,000 or less, but there are some exceptions. We have a few second-class cities that also by statute are eligible that exceed that 1,000 population. And I believe that you received a list of eligible communities, and those that are slightly larger than 1,000 are highlighted.
Thank you, Ms. Bowen. I would just like the record to reflect we were joined by Representative Carpenter at 2:52. Thank you. Please continue.
Thank you. So we accomplish our mission to support communities in a variety of ways. Primarily, we do this by funding, planning, design, and construction projects for water, wastewater, and solid waste improvements. And then we also provide assistance to the communities in administering and providing project oversight for those funded projects. So I'm ready for the next slide. We have an annual grant process for funding new Village Safe Water projects. And we're actually in the midst of that right now. It's an annual effort in the spring. Grant applications are scored on a variety of established criteria, but they primarily look at how the project will address a critical public health need and the community's capacity to successfully operate and maintain their existing facilities. So a little more specifically, we look at the current level of service that is provided in the community, and generally we're referring to whether the community has piped service, whether they are hauling water and wastewater, or if they're using, say, wells and septics. We also look at the beneficial health impact that the particular project is going to provide in the community. There's a small recognition to trying to be efficient in pairing up new projects with existing projects. So we do look at whether there's another relationship to another project, as well as the community's capacity or capabilities for operations, maintenance, and management of their utility. So once we go through the scoring process for all of the proposed projects, they're ranked in score order, and those that are highest are the ones that receive funding. Once we select a project for funding, we commit to funding it to completion, but we don't always allocate all of the funding at one time. So often for larger projects, we'll fund design in the first year, and that will give us a more improved cost estimate at the completion of design that we can then use to make decisions about funding construction, which we may do over the course of several years in phases. As the project is ready for more money, we will make it available. And so smaller projects may get funded fully all in 1 year, but those longer term projects that require funding over multiple years are placed on the multi-year priority list, and we continue to prioritize adding new funding to those projects before we take on any new projects. This method allows us to fund a greater number of projects at the same time and keep them all sort of moving along down the pipeline.
Thank you, Ms. Bohan. If you could just, when you're ready for the next slide, if you could just tell us the slide number that you're on to make sure that we're consistent with you. And we have a question from Representative Carpenter and then Representative Wohl. Representative Carpenter. And pardon me, let the record reflect, at 2:55 p.m. we were joined by Representative Edgman, and at 2:56 p.m. we were joined by Representative Rasmussen. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So I'm on slide 3. I'm not sure if that's the one you were talking to, but so I'm curious what the metric is, or what is the criteria by which you're judging capacity to operate and capacity to maintain?
Thank you. Through the chair, there's been over the years a number of different ways that this capacity has been evaluated. Since 2015, we're using a tool that we call the Operations and Maintenance Best Practices. It is based on three categories that were established in the Safe Drinking Water Act for looking at capacity, specifically water systems. And those are technical, financial, and managerial categories. So we work with our partners at the Rural Utility Business Advisor within the Department of Commerce, as well as several programs within DEC, to gather information from communities and use that to score them using the metrics in the operations and maintenance best practice scoring criteria. We then share that with the community. It's published on our website. We use it not only for determining funding eligibility and scoring, but it also allows all of the agencies that are working with the communities to have the same sheet of paper, if you will, to look at how the community is doing and where we all might be able to step in and provide some additional technical assistance to help them improve their capacity.
Thank you. Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chairman. I guess my question is along the similar lines, but as far as the community's capacity to operate and maintain, and you did mention fiscal, so if a community, I would assume they have to have the fiscal means to maintain and operate their system, or is that a continuation of a grant program or another grant program? Because you hear about systems being put in, but then there's no money to maintain them, and then that's a problem in itself. So is fiscal solvency or fiscal capability to pay for maintenance and operation a criterion?
Thank you. Through the chair, yes, we look under the financial capacity section. We do look at if the community has an adopted budget that's realistic and balanced. We look at if they're collecting sufficient revenues to cover the costs of operating and maintaining their system. And I guess I'll elaborate a little bit further. This isn't just a yes-no type of scoring. We developed the tool to also be used as a way of speaking with the communities about what they could be doing to improve their capacity. So each category has multiple tiers. And as you go up in tiers, there's a few more points assigned. And so we recognize that a community, for example, that has adopted a budget, whether it's even if it's not balanced, should receive some points, and then a community that has a balanced budget would receive more points, and a community that has a balanced budget and they're setting aside revenues for supporting their ongoing repair and replacement would receive even higher points. So there's sort of an encouragement to make gradual improvements that are very easy to identify.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Foster.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I know you're trying to address the issue of the catch-22 that maybe you're in, and that is the scoring system itself. You know, on the one hand, you know, communities that have the wherewithal to take care of their systems score higher, and therefore, you know, they get the funding. And then on the other hand, you've got communities that maybe don't have the sophistication and just the wherewithal and whatnot to maybe have a pipe system or whatever it is. And so what happens is those communities end up not getting maybe a pipe system, and they're stuck with, you know, the honey bucket system or whatever it might be. And so on the one hand, you need to have some kind of a process in place. But on the other hand, you've got communities that end up continually being, you know, in a situation where they don't get just basic services. And I know this is something that, you know, has been brought up to you, and there's really no simple answer to this, but I'm just wondering, I want to put it out there. It's a question that my office is continually, you know, looking at, and we've worked with you, and I guess I just want to put that out there, and also just see if you've got any general thoughts. I know it's a very difficult and a very complex thing to try to deal with, but just your thoughts.
Thank you, through the chair. Yes, it's not an easy, there's no easy solution to this issue. We do discuss this frequently, both internally and with our federal funding partners. And there's a couple of thoughts I can offer. One, we did make some adjustments this year to our eligibility criteria in recognition of exactly what you just described. And we lowered the eligibility score for unserved communities and underserved communities to have access to funds for what we call improvements to core infrastructure. So the intake and transmission to their water treatment plant, the sewer line and their disposal location, we would call that, the washout area as well. Those we consider to be the core infrastructure. And so we've reduced the minimum score required for eligibility to access funds to build a new or repair those core infrastructure in appreciation of, while we continue to strive for a solution to provide a more complete level of service in those unserved communities, we can at least make sure that the core infrastructure that they have is operational and appropriate to meet their current needs. And then we continue to work with all of our partners to focus on assisting the communities that are unserved, that are struggling with their capacity, to build that capacity. And it's a constant effort to look at the situation from different angles. I think we're seeing a lot of success in partnering with regional partners that are willing to step in and also provide some support, primarily in the financial area, to help the communities increase their capacity and thus be able to access construction funding as well.
And I just want to thank you for your recognition of the issue, and I know that you're trying to do things that will help, and I appreciate it. It's an ongoing process, I realize, so thank you.
Thank you. I see no further questions. If you'd like to continue, please.
Thank you. I think we'll move to slide four. So here we have just some information about a typical, if you could say there's a typical average Village Safe Water project, to provide piped service to homes for the first time, to pipe a community for the first time, the average cost per home is ranging somewhere between $350,000 and $750,000 per home. So it is a significant investment. I think we are looking at a handful of communities right now. I believe Tinunic has submitted an application for our consideration, and their cost estimate is somewhere in the neighborhood of $45 million to provide piped water and sewer. So these projects are certainly expensive, and they also take some time to complete. So typically the project, from planning through design and construction completion, can last anywhere between 5 to 10 years. And of course, that depends on the size and complexity of the project, funding availability, and then also, as we discussed, the community's ability to meet those capacity requirements to maintain construction funding.
Ms. Bohan, this is Representative Merrick. There were quite a few raised eyebrows when you read off those numbers, and a couple furrowed brows as well. Is it the cost of materials? Is it the cost to deliver them to the rural areas? What is it that drives that cost up so much?
Thank you. It's a little of each of those. The cost to mobilize materials and equipment, short growing season, because I've got some plant starts in front of me. Short construction season is certainly a contributing factor, and if things get delayed, we can miss an entire construction season very easily by missing a barge or having something go awry. The just Arctic engineering that goes into the construction that we're doing for the landscape and the climate that we're building in also raises a cost. I do think currently we're seeing construction costs skyrocket as a result of the pandemic. That has not been taken into consideration in this discussion here, and we'll have to see how long that persists. But combined, all of these different factors result in that high cost that we're seeing here.
Thank you very much for that. We have questions from Representatives Carpenter and Wool. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you again, Madam Co-Chair. It appears from the words on the slide that these numbers and timelines here are what has occurred in projects that have already been completed or at least started, as opposed to a projection of what we think it's going to take in the future. So we're basing this off of how we've been doing things more than how we could do things. That's accurate?
Through the chair, that's correct.
Thank you. Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So if a community gets a water system installed at these kind of numbers, call it average $500,000 per home, I'm assuming that if there's a water utility in place or some sort of service that charges for water sewer, I'm assuming they're not going to recover those costs, but yet people will have a utility bill. What's the average water sewer bill on a house that had a average cost of, say, $500,000 per home to have a water sewer system installed?
Through the chair, so the construction dollars that we're listing here are provided via grant. So the community is not taking on that expense. But you're correct that then the homeowners and other businesses are expected to contribute to the ongoing expenses through rates. I would have to pull together some numbers. I don't have those directly in front of me, but we do see user rates in some of our rural communities as high as $250 a month. But I could gather some information about more average costs.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, could you remind me, and I apologize, but if you'll indulge me, what is the goal setting we're talking about here? In other words, is this, I mean, the goal is lofty and honorable and all of those things, but is this a federal requirement, a state requirement? What are we trying to achieve?
Through the chair, I think our goal is to provide public health protection through access to safe drinking water and clean disposal of the wastewater. And there have been many studies that look at the various levels of service that are provided across Alaska, and certainly the health impacts associated with, say, a hauled system or a honey bucket system. There are health impacts to those types of systems, and a greater health benefit gained by access to both a larger volume of water on a daily basis, and also, of course, properly treated water that meets all safe drinking water regulations.
Representative Josephson.
Yeah, a follow-up. I guess what I meant was, are we subject to a court order? Is this a self-imposed deadline? Is it statute? Is it federal law? I want to finish this by 2030, but what happens if we don't finish it by 2050? That's the kind of question I'm asking.
Through the chair, we do have the Village Safe Water state statute that does direct us to construct infrastructure in the rural communities. There's, to my knowledge, no federal requirements. A public water system or a wastewater system must meet state and federal regulations, but those don't necessarily direct that there's a requirement to construct a new system.
Thank you. Representative Edgman.
Can you tell me how many villages that have been identified that don't have adequate water sources for water and sewer system? And I ask because I represented the community of Chifornik a few years ago outside of Bethel, and that was the big hurdle was to putting a water and sewer system was that they couldn't find suitable supplies of water to support a system.
Through the chair, off the top of my head, I couldn't give you a specific number of communities that have a water source issue, but we do work with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium and Indian Health Service to capture all known needs in our rural communities towards their sanitation. We capture and record those in a database that's maintained by Indian Health Service. And so I could certainly query that database and look for all the instances where we've identified a new water intake is or a new water source is needed.
Follow-up?
Well, and as a follow-up, looking at those large numbers, 350,000, 750,000 per home, I'm no engineer, not anywhere close, but I know just from experience that going back to the notion of being able to access water, a lot of it is tied to finding appropriate amounts of water and thinking of all these villages that are in tundra-like environments, impermeable surfaces, and, you know, costs that may not, you know, be the equivalent of in a, you know, in another, you know, urban setting or some other setting where there, you know, isn't the same sort of topographical features. But I think that's, you know, the big number up there is obviously because these communities are hard to get to. You got to barge up the river. You got to bring people out and Davis Bacon wages and, you know, just lots of expenses involved. And these numbers as eye-popping as they really are just reflect the reality of doing business out in rural Alaska in a lot of respects.
Thank you. Representative Foster.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. With regard to that number, the cost for first-time service, I'm just trying to get an idea of how that number is derived. I know, like, for example, in Nome, if I've got a lot in Nome and you've already got the water and sewer plants that's been built 40 years ago and that's already in place, you've already got the water lines and the sewer lines that go through the street, all I have to do is just pay for the water and sewer that goes from my house to the street, and so you dig a ditch and it might be 20 grand or whatever it is depending on how long the run is. To come up with this 350 to 750,000 per home, I'm wondering, does that include, you take the total cost of building a new, you know, water and sewer plant and the treatment facility and then running the lines through town and then you take the total number of homes that are being serviced, maybe there's, you know, 40 or 50 homes, and so that's the grand total cost of like the whole system, and then you divide that by the number of homes, and that's, is that how you're getting this number?
Through the chair, thank you. Yes, that's correct. And in fact, in 2016, we did commission a study to look at, not incredibly detailed, but to look at each of the unserved communities and develop a cost estimate for what it would cost to provide full pipe service to the entire community. And so we do have rough estimates that we're working off of for each of those unserved communities, but the methodology is as you described, it's to take the entire system from scratch and put in the entire network and then factor in the number of homes.
Representative Wool.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Are there situations where a water system is being developed for a community, and is like you said, the installation or design and engineering is paid for by grant, but the maintenance and operation is paid for by utility bills, where someone says, yeah, I'd love to have water and sewer at my house, but I don't really want to pay $250 or $300 a month, So you can skip my house when you're hooking up, because although I'd like to have it, I can't really afford it, and I don't want another bill along with my electric and heat. So does that situation arises, and then I guess it makes the price go up for everyone else, right?
Through the chair, absolutely. I think probably what's more likely to happen is that the plan sounds good at the get-go, and so maybe that home is provided service, but they then disconnect from service because they can't afford the user fees. But there have been some instances where a homeowner may choose not to be part of an initial project because they don't feel they can afford it. And then, as you described, it exacerbates the problem and drives up the cost for the rest of the group.
Follow up? Yeah, thank you. I guess that just presents a whole new situation where everyone gets hooked up. They go, wow, this is great. And then a 25% drop off because they can't afford it. Then the other 75% pay another 25% in fees. And then maybe they drop off because they're paying more in fees. And it seems a challenging situation, to say the least.
Thank you. I see no further questions. Please continue.
Thank you. I think we're ready to move to slide 5. Here we have a flow chart, if you will, of sort of the timing of a traditional project. So we accept applications for new planning projects every year in the spring. And maybe I'll pause on the timeline here for a moment and just mention that we require all projects to go through a planning project first. So we fund the community working with an engineering firm to identify the problem, flesh out potential solutions, and the associated cost estimates with those. The plans are then reviewed by a committee comprised of myself and the federal funding agencies that support our funding process, as well as Indian Health Service. And then we also include folks from our regulatory programs that would then have to review and approve the designs of the systems. So we do a comprehensive review of what would be proposed and try and address any questions or concerns that might arise at that level. Once we as a group approve that planning document, that allows the community to then apply for a construction grant. A typical design planning project, they would apply in the spring and receive funding in the fall and work with a contractor over the winter, usually between 12 and 15 months to complete the plan. So just based on the timing, that generally allows them to be eligible in the spring of the third year to submit an application for design and construction funding. Again, we make our awards in late summer, early fall. The project goes to design, which can take as much as 2 years. And then generally we begin construction in the spring when the barges are running up the river and can take supplies. Although we do have some construction work that requires frozen ground. So that spring time isn't always a dead set time frame, but construction can then last for 1 to 3 years to take the project to completion.
Thank you. Please continue.
So moving to slide 6, we have a summary of projects that we were able to fund in this past fiscal year or the current fiscal year. We funded 19 planning projects for 19 communities. These are small projects. Generally, they average around $70,000, but some that are simple can be as low as $25,000, and those that require a more thorough, often a geotechnical investigations can cost up to $250,000. So we allocated $1.9 million towards planning projects this year, and then $62.5 million was made available for construction projects. And here we were able to contribute additional funds to 19 ongoing construction projects and take on 13 new construction projects And again, these range between $300 and a little over $9 million. In addition to this, we work very closely with our partners at Indian Health Service and EPA that provide funding through the Indian Health Service's Sanitation Deficiency System funding cycle. We sit on the scoring committee for their process. They sit on the scoring committee for our process. So we're looking at all of the funding sources holistically and making sure no communities are falling through the cracks, if you will, in our processes. They had $48 million available this year, and were able to fund 35 construction projects in addition to those that we funded through Village Safe Water.
Thank you. Please continue.
So slide seven speaks to some of the other efforts that we have both in Village Safe Water specifically and within our facilities section at the Division of Water at DEC. So we work closely with partners to support the communities, as I've described, in their efforts to build their technical, financial, and managerial capacity. We also have a program that works closely with operators and system owners to oversee certification of operators and ensure that they're properly trained. We also have the remote maintenance worker program, where we work closely with five regional health corporations, as well as we have a handful of staff at DEC. We fund grants to the health corporations. Our funding comes from the Environmental Protection Agency and the USDA Rural Development. And we have 15 individuals. They're located across the state, and they each are assigned to work with 10 to 15 communities where they go out and do hands-on training and technical assistance and emergency response and support in those specific communities. Some of our RMWs or remote maintenance workers have been working with the same group of communities for over 20 years. So they're a pretty unique group of folks who occasionally spend their Thanksgiving working at 40 below to fix a broken water line or a frozen wastewater system, and really make sure that we're giving the communities the assistance they need in those difficult moments. And then also the last bullet notes that while we're able to fund technical assistance and infrastructure improvements, we're not able to provide funding for ongoing operations and maintenance.
Thank you. Please continue.
Okay. For the record, Ruth Kostick, Admin Services Director for DEC. On slide eight, you will see this is the what's in the governor's amended budget, capital budget for Village Safe Water for fiscal year 22. The match in this, which is the amended budget, is a slight increase over what was in the governor's budget. It's an increase of $2.3 million because the federal grants increased. The state match portion in the governor's budget was funded through AHFC bonds. The bills, both the Senate and the House bills to provide those bonds, have both stalled out. So if those bills don't go forward, the AHFC bond fund source in the budget will have to be replaced with some other, with general fund match or some other fund source. Okay. Slide number nine. There is also a supplemental request for Village Safe Water for increased match for fiscal year 21, which was an increase of $3.65 million. And that was because, again, increased federal support and the timing of when we become aware of the final federal grant numbers and last year's shortened session with COVID, we were not able to get an amended request in last year in time for the budget. So that is in the 21 supplemental.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, I think for the the ASD director. So put in its simplest form, if we don't, I guess, in the next 7.5 days, short of a special session, if we don't find $18,062,000, do we permanently waive $52,250,000?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, there's, I mean, we have to be able to have at some point make a commitment to our funding partners at EPA and USDA to accept those funds and make grants. We, for example, in fiscal year 21, we did ultimately grant out the full amount of federal, even though we didn't have the match yet identified in hand, with the understanding that we would, if need be, borrow from the next year's appropriation, assuming that we got it. But it is, we would at some point have to have a conversation with our funding partners if we were unable to find the match for either the federal funding for 22 or the 21 federal amount, federal funds.
Thank you. Please continue.
Okay. Slide number 10. So this slide is to give an idea of all the various funding sources that are coming into Village Safe Water and the other funding streams into rural sanitation. So over on the left-hand side, we have the state match and which is in the green bucket, and then the purple and the kind of gold bucket, which is the USDA and the EPA infrastructure grant funding. And those USDA and EPA funds are the ones that do require the state match. Those buckets are what fall into the what we consider our CIP program or traditional Village Safe Water projects that are on the multi-year priority list. You know, I think Carrie mentioned we partner with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium on these projects. So some of those funds flow through ANTHC, some flow through us to the projects. In addition to those funds, there's money that comes through Indian Health Service and the EPA Safe Drinking Water Act and Clean Water Act funding that go through their sanitation deficiency system list, which, as Carrie mentioned, we work through those lists in tandem to make sure that everything's getting funded as much as we can between those two lists appropriately. And then there's also some Indian Health Service money that flows through this third list, which is the housing priority system that can also support these types of projects. And on slide number 11, you can see so this is a funding history chart of the program. These colors carry forward from the previous slide. So the green on the bottom is, again, the state match portion, and everything up above it are all of the federal funds that come with that. The gold and the purple, again, are those EPA infrastructure grant and USDA rural development funds that do require the state match. The blue is Indian Health Service, and the brown is the EPA tribal, those Safe Drinking Water Act and Clean Water Act funds that don't require state match.
Thank you. Please continue.
Okay, slide number 12. So we get asked a lot, like, what is the total need? As Carrie mentioned before, based on the rough estimates to serve the remaining communities that are unserved, based on, again, that traditional piped system, in addition to upgrades to existing systems that are there, it's over $1.8 billion. Which is a big shocking number. But of course, most of that is that first time service because of that high cost per home for those traditional pipe systems. I would note on here that the yellow slice of the pie, the upgrades to address minor health threats, those can be the hardest to fund because they don't frequently rise to the level of scoring to get funded. So obviously substantial health threats are going to score higher on a list than minor issues. And those minor things might be things like we need to put a roof over the water tank so the water tank doesn't deteriorate faster. So there are little things like that.
Thank you. Please continue.
All right, slide 13. So we talked a lot about that high cost per home for the traditional pipe system, and acknowledging that in the past, in 2013, DEC launched the Alaska Water and Sewer Challenge Project, which is to identify other alternatives to that pipe system that's so expensive. This is really a research and development project. It started, we're in phase five right now, which is pilot testing phase, which is starting to get the systems out into some real-time use. We've got two systems right now, Carrie, that we're testing, I think, and one system, thank you, that's made it through kind of all of the previous phases. The target is a system that costs no more than around $160,000 per home to install, something that's easy to maintain, has limited freshwater input. It involves using recycled gray water for laundry and dishwashing and bathing. And of course, these would be kind of a system that's isolated to a single home. There are currently no standards at EPA for using recycled water for these non-drinking water things. So we're also working with EPA on establishing what those standards would be. The pilot testing has been delayed because of COVID, but hopefully we'll get going again in the fall. But this is a very exciting project. And it's been going on since I've been at DEC, so it's excited to see it get as far as it has.
Thank you. Please continue.
Okay, and slide 14. So outside of Village Safe Water, DEC does also have other infrastructure, water and wastewater infrastructure funding programs. There's the infrastructure protection funding. Several years ago, the House Finance Committee added an additional $4 million of match above and beyond what was required that year. And so those funds have been used to support smaller projects in Village Safe Water eligible communities to help extend the life of some of these systems. Those are small projects. But that was a one-time set of funding. So that money's been all allocated at this point. But we do have the program infrastructure in place now. There is also the municipal matching grant program that was funded for many years. That was a fully general funded program from the state where municipalities provided the match. And this was for larger cities to have their water and wastewater system projects funded. Because of obviously general fund issues, we have not funded any new projects since fiscal year 2016. I think most of those projects will be wrapping up in this current fiscal year. I think we'll have one that will linger into fiscal year 22. Until it's completed, but after that, we don't have any municipal matching grant projects on the horizon. And then there are the state revolving loan fund programs. So DEC, these are loan funds that are capitalized by federal funds every year, and DEC manages them to make low interest loans for clean water and drinking water infrastructure projects. Communities can use these and have been able to use these in the past to match their municipal matching grant projects. It's been interesting since the municipal matching grant program has phased out. use of the loans have definitely gone down. Communities were using those as a supplement to their grants. So we're definitely seeing less use of those loan funds. But we just wanted to share that these are just some other things. We're not just doing Village Safe Water infrastructure. As I know, there are conversations going on about the federal relief funds that are in that are eligible for water and wastewater projects.
Thank you. I see no questions.
All right. That's the end of our presentation.
Are there questions from the committee?
Just a general question.
Yes, Representative Edgman.
So there's potential of a lot of money coming into Alaska through these federal programs very broadly. What could that mean to all the efforts that you just sort of walked the committee through?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, as Carrie and I try and wait to see who's gonna go first so we don't have to. That's a very good question. I think there's a lot of, you know, there's potentially a lot of money in what's already been allocated to the state, as well as possibly even more coming through in another infrastructure bill that's coming. Our federal delegation have been very good about getting funds for Village Safe Water over the years, which is why we actually have to keep asking for more matching dollars, because they've been so good at driving federal dollars to Alaska for Village Safe Water. There's, you know, I think as Carrie mentioned, obviously prices have skyrocketed right now. So projects are just going to cost more in the next few years, and hopefully it's only a temporary thing. But there is a danger of you know, a glut of money coming into a program like this over a short period of time, exacerbating that issue, and challenges in finding contractors who are able to do the work, or reputable contractors who are able to do the work, particularly in the rural areas. I know there is a lot of need as well in the municipalities. We've heard from a lot of folks in the larger cities as well, as word of the federal funds were coming out, wondering how to get in line for that money. So I know there's need out there in those larger communities, as well as Village Safe Water. There's a lot. The current funds have 2 years roughly to spend them by 24. I think there's practical considerations about how much we could actually do in that time, with the capacity that we have.
So
follow up.
But that makes very good sense. I mean, there's only so much, you know, I'm just thinking, following up on Representative Foster's description about the per unit costs of, you know, so many barges out there, so many, tractors and backhoes and echo trailers and all the stuff that you need to put a crew in place for a summer or two or whatever it might take, depending on the amount of water in the river and cost overruns and all that stuff that tie themselves in $350,000 to $750,000 number. But I'm recalling just my last point, Madam Co-Chair, would be a presentation that ANTHC gave a couple of years ago here in the building, a lunch and learn. And what I remember is that the amount of aging systems out there is a big number. And I'm just a little surprised, and maybe at the graph on page slide number 12 would lead me to believe that there is more needs in terms of communities that don't have service, if I read that right, first time service, versus communities that need upgrades, because most of the communities have water and sewer systems, right? It's just a small number that don't. And am I reading this completely wrong, or is this just from the state's perspective, the water, Village Safe Water perspective?
Through the Carrie Bowen. So the graph that you're seeing on slide 12 comes directly from the sanitation deficiency system database I was describing, where we work along with ANTHC to enter project descriptions and cost estimates for all of the known needs in each of the communities. So we simply run a report each year and look at the categories of each of the projects and sum them up to create this graph. So this is based on known needs. And I think the disparity that you're describing between the first time service costs and the upgrades is simply because for each of the 28 remaining communities that are unserved, if we estimate somewhere between $50 and $60 million to construct a new system, that's where you get this blue colored number. Whereas the upgrades needed in existing facilities are come at a much lower cost for each of those systems to create the new improvements.
Thank you. Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, ladies, for the presentation. Very informative. I guess my question is regarding first-time service. And early in the presentation, Carrie made a reference to, or maybe it was Ruth, I'm sorry. It was a reference to a $45 million investment in a village, and I assumed it was a first-time service type investment. If the average cost is about $500,000 per user or structure, would that tell me that there's about 90 structures that would benefit from that project?
Through the chair, I trust your math. I agree that sounds correct. The community I was referencing was Tanunik has submitted an application for piped service. And I don't know off the top of my head what the number of homes is in that community, but we could certainly could provide that. But I think that the numbers that you were using are pretty accurate.
And that's a fair answer. And I guess really where I was headed, it's a combination of residential and non-residential structures, I would guess. So the question is, Is a community's population, could it be too small to qualify for this type of a program, and what would be that size? And then finally, measuring the expertise of the community to maintain the facility, how is that judged?
Through the chair, The question about the population being too small is an excellent question. We don't have a lower limit on eligibility, but I believe what you're getting to is that at a certain point that small population can't support the infrastructure. There's just not enough people to pay for that support. And so we look for other alternatives for providing that service, whether it's the Indian Health Service has a program that provides wells and septics to individual homes. Village Safe Water will also consider that as a project to, we have a project in front of us right now, I believe for Birch Creek, for exactly that, to install wells and on-site wastewater systems to each of the individual homes because they have so few in the community. And that's something that is appropriate for their size of community and their number of residents.
Follow up?
That follow-up would be, so I guess in theory, no community could be too small to receive some level of assistance.
Correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. I see no further questions. Thank you, Ms. Kostick and Ms. Bohan, for being with us today. That was very informative. And we will contact you if anything comes up. Thank you so much. We'll take a brief at ease. House Finance back on the record. Next, we'll hear more detail about one of the governor's capital budget requests within the Department of Law, $4 million for prosecutor recruitment and housing. Committee members have raised questions about a possible partnership with Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. So Brian Butcher with AHFC is online for questions. And we also have Mr. Skidmore. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Skidmore. If you could turn on your camera, state your name and affiliation, and begin your, tell us about your presentation that has to do with prosecutor housing and recruitment.
Good afternoon. Are you all able to hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Fantastic. For the record, my name is John Skidmore. I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Alaska Department of Law for the Criminal Division. And I was here to talk with you about our capital appropriation that's related to housing and other items. I describe it really as relating to recruitment and retention overall. There are four components to it. The largest and most important, of course, is going to be the housing component. When we look at recruitment and retention for the Department of Law, we see that we had a 25 to 37% turnover rate between 2018 and 2020 for our prosecutors. But when we looked at Bethel, that rate was actually 45%, and that's averaged out over the last 7 years. We know that retention in Bethel is a tremendous problem for us, and as we've talked with our folks in Bethel and other places around the state, we've been able to identify that one of the most critical components for us is, in fact, housing. The housing is broken down really into three categories: the availability of the housing, the quality of the housing, and the affordability. In terms of the availability, I have stories from some of our prosecutors about arriving in the office and having to sleep on the office floor for weeks at a time while they're attempting to secure housing. I myself have lived in two different rural communities in Alaska, in Dillingham and in Bethel. And in both locations, early in my career when I was in those locations, I first in Bethel had difficulty locating housing. And in fact, I was in three different places within a period of 6 months. When I was in Dillingham, I was fortunate that one of our sister agencies, the Department of Fish and Game, actually had employee housing that I was able to borrow for the first month that I was in Dillingham before I could eventually secure housing there. In both locations, challenges for housing were finding units that were available that were also appropriate for us. In both instances, I personally ran into problems of people who wanted to rent me a home that actually were people that the office had prosecuted at some point in the recent past, and I had to be careful about conflicts of interest. In both locations, just finding a sufficient volume of housing has been difficult. The quality of the housing, you know, some of those stories that I hear from our folks are problems with locks on the front doors. We had a young female prosecutor who was living in Bethel who didn't have a lock on the front door and had to secure that front door with the shower curtain rod for quite some time. We also have issues with good water. I've listened to the previous presentation. I can now understand some of the challenges of finding good water in rural Alaska. Working appliances. We have folks that have been in housing units for over 6 months saying, my oven doesn't work, and still not being able to get that addressed. These are the sorts of challenges that are presented for our folks that go there, and I think help explain why those folks don't necessarily stay in those communities long-term the way we'd like them to. And, of course, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention affordability. Right now, we have instances in which individuals have been asked to not only make a security deposit, but to also pay the first and last month's rent all up front. That's, of course, in addition to dealing with any student loan debts that they might have and any moving costs that they might have incurred having moved to a new area. These are all challenges for us in trying to both attract and then retain good quality people for any lengthy period of time. Now, the good news in all of this is that we all happen to be here together on a historic day. You all may not realize this, but there was legislation that was enacted, became effective 31 years ago, today, May 12th of 1990, there was a bill that was passed that authorized various departments in state government to own and operate housing for their employees to try and meet their responsibilities The Department of Law was one, the Department of Public Safety, the Department of Transportation, and Fish and Game are the other three. I think the other three entities, the other three departments, have all taken advantage of this authority that they were granted under this legislation passed 31 years ago. The Department of Law has not yet gotten into that game, and we've come to the conclusion that it's well past time for us to do so. The concept that we have is to be able to build or procure housing that already exists. I will be the first to admit that while I purchased my own home, I don't in any way think that I have the expertise to be engaged in purchasing of housing in rural Alaska, because I'm not an expert in that area. And we had originally looked at programs that the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation had and had come to the conclusion that we didn't think those programs were necessarily what we were looking for. But as we've engaged in other conversations with folks there in the legislature, and we've reached out again, and I've had the opportunity to have conversations with people over at AHFC, including Mr. Butcher, he and I think, agree that there is an excellent opportunity here for us to partner with them in the sense that they would be able to give us advice about what should be reasonable costs, what would be good quality building materials that we ought to be looking for in those areas, since they've helped others with those things in the past, to give us advice on logistics of trying to get materials from urban Alaska out to rural Alaska. I heard in the last presentation the challenges with ferries and the barges that would actually go out to rural Alaska. I remember those same challenges when I lived in both Bethel and in Dillingham. And the importance for us, of course, is trying to be able to issue an RFP, assuming that you all were to give us funding to do this. We would want to issue an RFP just as quickly as possible in order to be able to take advantage of the construction season, because there truly is a construction season in Alaska. And we know that time is ticking on our ability to do those things.
Mr. Skidmore?
In terms of managing it.
Pardon me, Mr. Skidmore. We have a question from Representative Rasmussen.
Sure.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I guess I was just curious if there had been any properties identified in these areas. I will admit that I do not have really any experience with real estate in rural Alaska, but for almost a decade now, I've worked in the real estate world in Anchorage and the Mat-Su, both as a real estate agent and as an appraiser. And I think that $300,000 may be feasible if they're modular homes, but to actually build, especially given the price of lumber increasing in the last year, I'm not sure if that's all accounted for in this proposal, and I just feel like there's a lot of unanswered questions for me at this point with the capital spend there.
Well, through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, that's an excellent question, and I'm glad you brought it up. When we proposed $300,000, we had done an RFI before the legislative session began, but since that time, we are all aware that the cost of building materials have increased. In the RFI that we did, $300,000 was not the highest amount, but it felt like a decent ballpark to us. In my conversations with Mr. Butcher in the last several weeks, he's actually indicated to me that he thinks the costs are more likely $350 to $400, depending on who we're able to contract with, and could even potentially go up as high as $600,000. So I have $300,000 in the talking points that we've sort of handed out to you all, but that was a very rough idea. Obviously, we have not been through an RFP yet, and I readily acknowledge it may end up costing more than what we've listed there.
Follow-up?
Just a quick follow-up statement. Yeah, I mean, just in Anchorage right now, building brand-new construction, you can't even hardly get into the market if you're under $500,000 for new construction, and this is not majorly large houses. We're talking about, you know, 18 to 2,200 square feet with a two- or three-car garage. Just for reference, the cost of building a 200 square foot deck is increased from about $900 to $1,000 up to almost $4,000. So the costs of material have absolutely skyrocketed. And I just don't want to put the cart before the horse here, I guess, and invest in real estate when it's actually not the greatest time to do so. I don't know if there are any other options for housing, if the department has thought about that at all, but I'm not sure that building brand new construction is the best option at this exact point in time.
Thank you. Through the chair to Representative Rasmussen, our proposal is not simply to build. Our proposal would want to look for existing structures that are out there. I'm aware that the FAA has some housing that they may be getting rid of. I am aware of other entities that may or may not have some housing that would be available. We are not ruling out any possibilities. Our request is merely just trying to secure funding for us to be able to look into it. We can't even really put an RFP out to the community and get responses back unless we actually had anything authorized for us. So I appreciate those concerns, and we are absolutely wanting to look at all options.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So in the RFP, are you looking for one consultant to deal with all of those communities, or are you going to be looking at an RFP for each community as all of the markets, I would assume? I defer to the rural members on that, but I would assume that those four markets are quite different in the real estate side of things.
So through the chair to Representative Rasmussen, again, that's an excellent question. We listed the order of priority. We would actually just start in Bethel. We don't believe that the amount of money that we're requesting would allow us to go out to the other communities yet. This would be more of a pilot project to test this in the Bethel area first. That's where our greatest need exists. If there was sufficient money to go beyond Bethel, I'd absolutely do that, but I'm not anticipating that that would actually be the case this time.
Representative Rasmussen.
Madam Co-Chair, and so how many units are you anticipating that you need in Bethel at this point?
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, we anticipate needing somewhere between 9 to 10 units, and so we think that would take up the $3 million that would be targeted specifically for housing.
And then you're going to look to similar amounts for the three subsequent communities at a later date?
The housing that we need in the subsequent communities, there are only two in Kotzebue, there are only two in Uktiavik, and there are 2 to 3 in Nome. So the numbers that we need in the other places are probably the equivalent of what we do in Bethel. And I readily acknowledge that each of those communities may be different. The RFI that we initially did solicited information from those communities. We didn't get a significant response from any community other than Bethel at this time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Skidmore, it's Representative Merrick. Under affordable housing, you mentioned moving expenses. Does this department not help new prosecutors when they're moving out to these locations with moving expenses?
Chair Merrick, that's an excellent question. We provide some assistance. We are not in a position to pay all moving expenses. And generally, our moving expenses are capped at somewhere, I want to say at $6,000. And that $6,000 is all inclusive of airfare for the employee and any family members they may have, as well as moving any of their household goods. We find that it can vary substantially from the recent graduate of law school who doesn't have a whole lot of material goods themselves that can be fairly inexpensive. And if that person's already located, for example, in Anchorage, it may not be expensive to relocate them to rural Alaska. But if you're looking for someone that is married with several children and is coming from the lower 48 and has already built up a household, that can be a substantially different picture. But our budget right now is not designed to provide more than that amount of assistance in housing.
Okay, thank you. I see no further questions. If you'd like to continue, please.
Thank you. And so all of the questions that you all are asking are exactly on point for us. We would like to partner with AHFC to get advice from them on how we can go about figuring out these various details. We have looked at modular units. We have looked at one or two bedroom where the walls are shared. We've thought about houses. We've thought about all sorts of different options, and we really want to look at what's out there and available. But the other thing that we were really interested in doing is also partnering with the Department of Public Safety, a sister agency for us. Their folks and our folks are going to be in the same communities. They already have a unit or a section within their department that manages housing for them, and we want to partner with them. And I've had conversations with Recently confirmed Commissioner Cockrell, as well as the Deputy Commissioner Leon Morgan, about trying to partner with them and help pay some of the costs that they have for managing housing, as well as the fact that if their folks and our folks are co-located, that actually can result in other benefits for us. In socializing, in my experience over the last 22 years, if you are also socializing with some of the folks in law enforcement that you end up having cases with, it creates greater lines of communication about those cases and actually can make for more effective prosecutions as well as investigations on the front end. So that's our plan as it relates to housing and what we're trying to do there. And I guess I'll pause there in case there are any other questions about housing. If not, then I'll move on to the other aspects of the $4 million request.
Thank you. Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Mr. Skidmore, just real quickly. So I had some concerns about the Department of Law getting into the housing business, but you may have assuaged them by your comment about partnering with DPS, and you noted that they do that already. Is that right?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, that's absolutely correct. The Department of Law is not set up to administratively manage such things. We recognize that. We're not looking to expand our administrative division to do that, but those resources already exist for the Department of Public Safety. They have a much greater need for that than we do, and they've been engaged in this since they were authorized 31 years ago. And so we would look to partner with them and benefit from that, but we also recognize that would mean we need to help share some of those costs.
Follow-up?
And then similarly, as to major maintenance and replacement, you would strive to benefit from their know-how? Is that the idea? Because it's unclear to me how the department would do it without assistance when it comes to issues like major maintenance and replacement.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I think the answer to that is really twofold. First, the statute that actually authorizes us to operate housing also authorizes us to charge rent that then we're able to use for that ongoing maintenance. We ourselves would not be going out there with the tools to do the maintenance ourselves, but it does allow us then to contract with others, whether that be the Department of Transportation, whether that be independent contractors that are out there. These are the sorts of issues that the Department of Public Safety has already had to deal with, and that we would want to rely on some of their expertise in how to do those things. We also believe that AHFC may be able to provide us some guidance on some of the ways that we might be able to do that sort of maintenance. But again, you're absolutely correct. We're not going to have lawyers doing the maintenance. We intend to contract that out to other people, and we would use the rent that was collected to pay for it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
So that's the housing component. As you all will note very astutely, we're asking for $4 million. I've indicated $3 million is really dedicated to the housing. The other components are also focused on recruitment and retention. For us, recruitment and retention includes trying to develop more professional materials that we can use when we go to job fairs or when we are talking to individual applicants. So we want to be able to contract out to someone to help us be able to create those more professional materials, as well as the fact that we want to review and try to improve our strategies of how we go about recruiting. That's all-inclusive from, can we partner with law schools on internships and externships programs? Can we find other areas or places to post our recruitments? As well as, I would very much be interested in being able to go and do what I call targeted talent recruitment. I think other people call it colloquially headhunting. I want to go and find prosecutors from the lower 48 that have experience, particularly in sexual assault or sexual abuse of minor cases, because those are not the type of cases that you can just hire somebody out of law school to do. We need to find experienced prosecutors who can come in and help us do that sort of work, and we need to have that ability fairly quickly. If we are fortunate enough to have passed what you all voted on recently, which was the 10 new prosecutor positions for sexual assault and sexual abuse of minor cases, that's one of the areas that we want to do this in. Another area is we have a position that we created in the last year called a prosecutor training specialist. That person is designed, or that position is designed, to help us do training for all of our folks. That position has been in recruitment now for 9 months. We have had very limited interest expressed in it, and the limited interest that we have has not had the type of experience that we've deemed as necessary to be effective in that position. So being able to go out and do that type of targeted, talented recruitment is crucial to us, and we believe we'd be able to do that with capital appropriation money because it would be a one-time spend. And then the third area that we're really looking to spend money in is training. I mentioned it just a moment ago. The Department of Law has done, specifically the Criminal Division, has done surveys with our employees, both current and those that have departed. And one of the other areas that we've identified that's an area we need to improve in is the quality and the quantity of training that we provide to our folks. The training specialist is one way in which we want to do that, but the other ways we're looking to do that is to develop or procure some off-the-shelf materials in trial advocacy, in best practices for sexual assaults and sexual abuse of minors. One example is the forensic experiential trauma interviewing, and that's a program that has been developed and is trademarked in the lower 48. It's actually recommended in the National District Attorney Association's Women Prosecutors Section white paper, which was a best practices for sexual assault that they published back in 2018. They specifically mentioned this type of training, and ironically enough, within the last year, as I was talking with Katie Teepoff, a trainer for the Department of Public Safety on domestic violence and sexual assault, she had had this same concept, not realizing it was also in this white paper. So there are things like that that we would like to be able to go out and procure that we think would be very beneficial. The other aspect of training that we have listed in those talking points, and I've reached out to the University of Alaska about this, we don't have a facility that we can do training in. I was fortunate in my career, probably within 5 years of joining the department, there was a program in South Carolina, Charleston, South Carolina, that was run by the federal government that did trial advocacy training for prosecutors all across the country. Within about 4 or 5 years after that, that program was restricted to only federal prosecutors. And so we have struggled since then to provide adequate trial advocacy to our prosecutors. We've done it periodically, but not frequently enough. And that's one of the things we want to try and fix. I reached out to the University of Alaska because one of the things we'd also like to do is to try and remodel one of their classrooms so that the bottom of the classroom looks like the well of a courtroom. And then it's a place that you can do trial advocacy training. That would be a benefit both to us and the Department of Law, as well as to the university for their programs in criminal justice classes. I've talked to a number of their professors who are also excited about that sort of a concept, and I talked with their administration about the possibility of doing these sorts of things. Again, that's a program that we would like to pursue, and we're simply waiting to determine whether or not we'd be given the money so that we can go out and do an RFP to try and do that sort of a remodel. Let me pause there before I move on to the fourth and final item in case there are any questions.
I see no questions. Thank you, Mr. Skidmore.
Thank you. The last thing then that we have is really about the installation of secure Wi-Fi in courthouses. The Department of Law around 2014, made a shift in our case management system. We were a department that primarily relied on paper files, and we would take those files to court with us. We would document what was happening in court. We'd bring them back. When they had to be opened up, we were waiting for paper copies from law enforcement of police reports and whatever else. They'd get put into those files, tacked down in those files, and then when it was time to go to court, we'd have to run around and find the files. It was not a very efficient system, but it was what was available originally. We shifted to a more digital system in 2014. That system now allows us to store and keep our files electronically in a cloud system and then to be able to access them. It is much more efficient for us, but we have not completed the implementation yet. And there are two ways in which that's still trying to occur. The first is when we go to court, if we don't have access to that case management system, we still have to have some sort of paper copy. We need Wi-Fi access to be able to make that happen. There is public Wi-Fi in the courthouses, but that's not secure. And we deal with information that has to be secure. It also, that public Wi-Fi is available to any member of the public. And so anybody else that comes in with their iPhone or their iPad and is looking at their email or video on YouTube, if they're trying to kill time while they're in the courtroom, that takes that bandwidth that's available to them. And so we've been engaged in a project of installing a dedicated line in courthouses throughout Alaska that only the Department of Law would have access to so that our prosecutors can utilize that when they go into the courtroom and access the case files. This allows us to get rid of the paper files. It allows us then to have our files completely electronic, which then also create benefits for us in how we achieve archiving and records retention. And when we're able to dispose of those files, it eliminates the need for us to have to run around and look for files. It makes us much more efficient. But it's another piece of that puzzle for us. And lastly, another piece of the puzzle is ensuring that data that comes to us in an electronic format. We are in the process of building interfaces with law enforcement agencies. We'd like to do the same thing with the court system. And we need a secure interface between us and them so that we are able to do electronic filing and in return get court dates and other orders that are issued by the court sent to us electronically so that it can automatically populate our system. I'm sure that you all are familiar with the recent cyber attack that's occurred to the courthouse and to the Alaska court system. That's one of those things that we're going to be talking about and working with them on, but we're also looking for money to help us develop a secure interface to make both us and them more efficient, and hopefully also to ensure that we're more secure on both sides. So that's overall what we're requesting the money for. I'm happy to answer any questions that you all may have for me about any of that.
If I might, on the subject of recruitment.
Representative Josephson.
Mr. Skidmore, in a typical work week, how long does a prosecutor work? Is it like 60 hours? Is it 50? How many hours?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I wish I had an exact number for you. I don't. We don't track the number of hours that people work, but I can tell you this. My own experiences, having been in the department for 22 years, when I handled caseloads in the offices, I think it was very regular that I was working somewhere between 60 and 80 hours a week. When I was in trial, my wife used to tell me that she was really a widow or a single parent during those times because I would be prepping my trials on the weekends, late at night, early in the morning. I was eating dinner in front of my file. I was not a help in raising our children in those times. And so I had to make sure that I dedicated myself to that in times that I wasn't in trial. But even then, there's a substantial amount of work that we do. We are certainly working well beyond the 37.5 hours that we are supposedly compensated for currently.
Follow up? Last follow-up. And you, because you're partially exempt, or your attorneys are, there's been no COLA for a number of years, true?
I believe that's correct. Actually, I've had several of my attorneys point that out to me recently, that I don't think partially exempt employees have had a COLA for, I want to say 7 years, but I don't know the number off the top of my head. But that's what I've heard.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Skidmore. We appreciate you being here. I want to give one opportunity for Mr. Butcher with AHFC to make any comments. Mr. Butcher, if you'd like to.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think Mr. Skidmore has done a pretty good job. The only thing I might add is AHFC would have the possibility of helping the Department of Law with a lot of the maintenance issues they may have. As example, we run over 100 public housing units in Bethel. We also have public housing units in Nome. We certainly have maintenance staff to take care of those. And so it would probably be a fairly inexpensive aspect of the housing for the department. As well, I'd like to mention that the Department of Public Safety has asked us to work with them on putting together a comprehensive list of housing needs out in rural Alaska, and we're in the process of putting that together right now.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for Mr. Butcher? Seeing none, we appreciate you being here with us today. And this concludes our agenda for this afternoon. Our next meeting is tomorrow, Thursday, May 13th at 9 a.m. We will take public testimony on House Bill 157, APOC, Report Referenda Recall Contributor by Representative Rasmussen. And with that, at 4:16 p.m., we are adjourned. Thank you.